First, I just want to take a moment and thank the entire West End community for having me here today, including Dr. Phelps, who has, he and I have developed a fast friendship since he's moved here to Nashville. And of course, I'm thrilled to be here speaking with you today, talking about the piece that is the best that we've got. In choral orchestral music, there's nothing better, in my biased opinion. We have nothing better. We have no piece that reaches people on the level that this piece does. No piece is equaled in terms of symphonic development. No piece is equaled in terms of the lyricism of the solos. And I think no piece is equaled in terms of how it reaches people on a communicative level, which I think is perhaps the most important thing about any piece of choral music. Because as I say to my students all the time, what do we have that orchestras don't? And the answer is quite simple, the text. We must communicate the text above all else. And Herr Brahms was particularly concerned about how the text would be perceived by his German countrymen. That is why it is ein deutsches Requiem, a German requiem. But as we'll learn in this short talk, he would have preferred not to call it a German requiem at all, but a human requiem, which is even more powerful. This piece is a piece unlike any other, in that this is a non-liturgical text, meaning that it was not pulled from the Catholic Bible. It was not in Latin, which, if you think of every other great requiem, the Verdi, the Berlioz, the Mozart, Bach's Mass in B minor, everything is in liturgical Latin. This was one of the first pieces ever written on this grander scale with a non-liturgical text. Also, the intention of this piece to be sung in the vernacular, meaning that every person in the audience, regardless of their education, regardless of the fact of whether or not they spoke Latin, would understand the piece. This piece was not necessarily designed to be performed in a church. It might have been performed in a concert hall. How many of you have ever heard the Verdi Requiem before? Of course, one of our greatest staples. However, I know many, many of my colleagues don't even consider that piece a choral work. It's more like an opera written for the church. The singers have tremendous responsibilities. The chorus almost serves like an opera chorus, commenting on the action. In this particular piece, the chorus has quite a starring role. But what is the most famous movement from the Verdi Requiem? You'll have to forgive me, I'm a professor, so we'll do some Socratic things here, and I'll ask you to answer some questions. What is the most famous, most excerpted movement from the Verdi Requiem? I'll give you a hint. Big bass drums. Yum, bum, yum, bum, yum, bum. It is the Dies Irae, of course, the Day of Wrath, which is ubiquitous among liturgical masses. If you know the Mozart Requiem, which we should probably stop calling it that, because his student, Zismayr, completed most of it, according to most modern scholarship. Mozart only wrote sketches of what that piece would look like. It was his student who completed it. Now, the Dies Irae of the Mozart Requiem, perhaps the most excerpted, perhaps the most beloved. Funny story about the Verdi. In the first performance, it was customary at that time to ask for encores. Do you know how many times the Dies Irae of the Verdi Requiem was asked for encore in the opening performance? Six. Six times. The audience would not let him go on. Now, if you know the Verdi Requiem, then you know that the Dies Irae comes back six more times in the piece. That must have been a long night. The Dies Irae in this piece, however, is conspicuously absent. Brahms decided not to put the Dies Irae text into this piece. And we'll find out why a little bit later. But if you're thinking about Catholicism and the Catholic interpretation of the Old Testament, we are talking about hellfire. We are talking about damnation, punishment. Brahms did not accept these ideologies as part of his religious philosophy. Instead, he was much more concerned with salvation. This ignores the Catholic idea of representation of damnation, and instead, we are secure in our blissful eternity. We know that after death, things will be better than they were here on earth. Now, if you don't know anything about Brahms, the first thing I need to tell you is that his life was not pleasant. His life was not pleasant. He was very, very close to his mother, who suffered much of her life from disease. He was very, very concerned about her for many, many years of his adult life. And of course, because of that association, he had trouble moving on into his professional life. There's a saying now, a modern saying, a failure to launch. And Brahms definitely had a failure to launch. However, he loved the idea of resting from the struggles of life in God's dwelling. He loved the idea of eternal salvation. And he thought that this blissful entity would be so much better than anything here on earth. We'll talk about a contemporary of his and how he engaged that philosophy in a great deal of his work. Now, the overall textual and philosophical emphasis of this piece is man's acceptance of death, which leads to his triumph, accepting of death as part of life. And again, I mentioned, he didn't even want to call it the German Requiem. To a friend, he said, "This is more of a human requiem. I want this to be a requiem for those who are still alive, not a mass for people who have passed on and are now dead." Again, a very different idea. Brahms lived in an incredible time in human history. So many events happening across Europe and the United States. And if I dare say, he was a handsome young man. He was born in Hamburg. He was a student of his father, who was also a professional musician at that time. And you may know this, that he had a fondness for folk music. Not only German folk music, his heritage, but also Hungarian folk music. He lived in a particular area of Germany that had a great Hungarian presence. A lot of his friends were Hungarian, and they taught him the language and those songs. If you know the choral music of Brahms, you know that most of his music is folk-related. Actually, the greatest part of his output are folk songs and arrangements of folk songs. One more area where he was ahead of his time. He was a close friend of Robert Schumann, the famous composer who was also a literist. He went, reviewed concerts. Some of the music literacy and some of the music reviews of Schumann are truly outstanding, really, really incredible, quite biting, as a matter of fact. You would never expect to open the New York Times and read such biting critique of composers like Berlioz, whom Schumann thought was a waste of air. That is a quote. Now, Bach enthusiast was Brahms. Brahms knew the music of Bach. He knew the cantatas of Bach. He was a choral conductor himself. He worked in a church much like this. He was a pretty good organist, kind of like me. I call myself a one-and-a-half-footed organist. He was a one-and-a-half-footed organist, but a brilliant keyboardist. And one of the things that was very important to him was bringing and resurrecting the music of great German masters. Now, please remember that at this time, Bach was not the God that we know today. As a matter of fact, once again, in the Socratic method, who among all of the German Romantic composers can we thank the most for even knowing who Johann Sebastian Bach is, madam? Mendelssohn, of course, who all of a sudden discovered all of this music that this gentleman had written and said, "There's genius." Brahms would have known Bach's music, and he studied it. He also studied Renaissance music along with Baroque music. He was a student of all of these things. Composed a number of works for choir and orchestra, including a piece that I was fortunate enough to do earlier this year, the Schicksalslied, the Song of Fate, which closely mirrors the beginning of the first movement of the Brahms Requiem that you'll hear today. He also wrote a piece called Nennia, which the National Symphony and the Symphony Chorus performed last year. And finally, a stunning piece of music that unfortunately isn't done enough, the Alto Rhapsody, a piece for men's chorus, orchestra, and a contralto. It's one of the most stunning pieces of music. It's 10 minutes you'll never wish you had back in your life to sit and listen to the Rhapsody of Brahms. Without craftsmanship, inspiration is a mere reed shaken in the wind. Brahms was a consummate craftsman. He knew the music of Palestrina. He knew the music of Schütz. He put together music in such a way as to make it have form, structure, and substance. But as I mentioned, along with that craftsman ideal, he was a tortured soul. This was not a person who found a great deal of happiness on earth. One of the reasons, much of Brahms' choral music reflects a deep personal despondency about life that he shared in a great deal of his letters, both to his friends and, of course, to love interests that we'll get into in just a moment. We were talking a little bit earlier about the Geistliches Lied. Lass dies nur nicht dich dauern, let nothing ever grieve you. A stunning, canonic imitation work that is reminiscent of Renaissance pieces. This would have been done with the organ and the choir, this Geistliches Lied. If you're going to do anything when you go home today, besides buy a recording of Ein Deutsches Requiem, find this piece. It will bring you peace. It is designed to do so. But it's a great example of that style and what Brahms was pouring into his music at that time. Most of his sacred and many of his secular compositions reflect that person that I told you about before. Otto Schopenhauer was a philosopher who was a contemporary of Brahms, and he believed that life was pain and afterlife was glorious, and life was something that was to be endured. I mentioned Schicksal's Lied a little bit earlier. That piece is all about how man is thrashed on the rocks, and you're suffering and suffering and suffering until at which point God decides you are allowed to join him in the heavenly kingdom and everything will be better. That was Schopenhauer's idea of life, and it was very congruent with the way that Brahms was existing at the moment. Nothing was going well. He wasn't making money at his compositions. He wasn't finding that he was gaining the kind of notoriety that he wanted. This was a tortured soul, someone who wasn't very happy. And Arthur Schopenhauer was the perfect congruency to that idea. Now, there is the matter of Robert's wife, Clara, who is a fine musician and composer. Johannes Brahms and Clara Schumann did have a relationship. They wrote hundreds of letters back and forth to one another. However, the timing for Johannes, once again, wasn't so good because Robert developed syphilis, became very, very ill, mentally ill, in fact, and began to do things that we would only describe as something that would need to be medicated. Of course, nothing like that at the time. So he was insane. Now, living with this, Johannes at times lived in their home, was in love with Clara, and this unrequited love is often poured into all of Brahms' music, especially the symphonies. As I mentioned, he was a student of music history. He preferred formally structured compositions based on canon, close imitation, which means canon, of course, is just like row, row, row your boat, except much more complex. Canonic imitation, you'll hear things this afternoon that are quoted in one voice and then brought back in another voice. Also, short imitation, you'll hear an instrument play a motif, and then it'll be passed to another instrument, and then to a voice, and then to another instrument. It's almost like a fun little game of tennis in the music. And if it's happening correctly, your head should be going like this. It's the fun part, just like watching a tennis match. He studied Renaissance and Baroque music throughout much of his life, and he utilized canon in augmentation, cantus firmus, passacaglia, and inverted melody. I'll show you the inverted melody thing. It's very cool. The passacaglia, of course, is a bass line that continues throughout an entire movement, something that you hear in this piece. And then cantus firmus was a medieval compositional technique that Brahms knew about, and he illustrated in his music. For example, in movement 4 of the Requiem, listen for the soprano. It is a direct inversion, her first entrance. It is a direct inversion of what the orchestra just said. Now, I'll show you what that looks like, and I'll even sing it for you in just a moment. His music was highly personal. At its premiere in Bremen, on Easter Sunday of 1868, the work only had 6 movements. Later, after the death of his mother, what we now know as the 5th movement, Ihr habt nun Traurigkeit, called for soprano solo, was composed later, after the death of his mother, as a tribute. The other movements that has a personal connection of this sort, the composer's 2nd, which opens with the 2nd movement, which opens like with a powerful dirge-like funeral movement. And what I want you to listen for is the timpani. The timpani in this particular piece, and also in the Schicksalslied, and also in Nania, which will be played by Colleen, and she'll do a great job, is the sound of fate. Bo, 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 bo. Unstoppable, unmitigating, doesn't matter what happens in the music around it, that timpani line means time is marching on, and you only have so much time on this earth to complete the things that you need to do. So listen for the timpani, because it's thought that he engaged that after the suicide attempt, the first suicide attempt of his friend Robert Schumann. The first movement, Selig sind. Here is the original copy of the first time the choir enters, available in the Bach Gesellschaft. It's really, really incredible to see. The first movement, you need to listen to this like it is a piece of Lieder, like it is a German art song, instead of what Beethoven might do or Haydn might do, where he takes small motivic ideas and extrapolates them in development and exposition, like a symphonic composer would. Brahms spills out the melody like a German art song would. The melody expands and contracts, and it's all about the melodic line, nothing else. Whereas Beethoven would have created little motivic ideas and inserted them or developed a theme, Brahms instead stretches the melody to beautiful proportions. We begin in F major. Now, I have a quick story to tell you about this first movement. I had an audition at Eastman for their conducting program. It is a very, very tenuous process, but I was a finalist. And my last part of my audition was they opened the full score to the Brahms Requiem, to the first movement, and Dr. Weinert said, "Okay, young man, play." Now, if you know anything about music, you know that reading open score is particularly difficult, because you have to deal with a variety of clefs, transpositions. Well, the first movement of the Brahms Requiem has no violins. It opens with double divisi viola, and they read alto clef, not something that pianists are used to reading. Now, I didn't have much success playing open score the first movement of the Brahms. I wish I had it back, but alas, it'll be something I'll never forget. The use of a cappella singing was still relatively new in choral orchestral writing. It was very rare to have the choir singing without the orchestra playing. Brahms uses it to great effect in this first movement. And also, I want you to listen to the sighing motive that expresses the text, Die Tränen sind, die Tränen, with the tears are falling. Now, those who sow with tears, Bach would have done the same thing. You'll hear the tenor sing, if there's a better musical depiction of sadness or sighing, you'll have to show it to me. Now, Brahms didn't come up with this himself. This was an homage to Bach. Bach would use descending chromatic lines on the words sehen, or sehnsucht, or seufzen, words that meant longing, pain. Schmerz was a big one. You'll need to learn the word schmerz by this afternoon. Movement 2. Perhaps this one will ring a bell in your mind. Listen for the timpani again. Brahms puts the fate in the timpani. He liked it to symbolize the ever-approaching march of death. The opening melody is reminiscent of something that's in your hymnal. Denn alles Fleisch wie ist wie Gras. Kind of sounds like
If thou but trust in God to guide thee.
That's in your hymnal, page something. I don't know what it is. I know what it is in the Episcopal hymnal, but not in this one. Now, that was a direct quote from that hymn. Brahms knew it. He loved it. It was Georg Neumann in 1657. Again, another homage to Bach, putting a chorale in the middle of a movement of a choral orchestral. Also, this movement offers extreme contrasts in sorrow and joy with a mighty fugue that seemingly comes out of nowhere. Seemingly out of nowhere. You'll be surprised by it, like Haydn would have surprised you in music. The third movement, Perdonere doch nicht, dass ein Ende mit mir haben muss. The first appearance of our baritone. The first time the soloist appears. Brahms never wrote an opera. He never wrote an opera. He wrote overtures to operas, and it's thought that there are some sketches of operas because he made very little money. An opera made the money in Germany. But he never finished. He never did it. Instead, he focused most of his time on liturgical works. He acknowledges Beethoven in this movement, movement 3, with a direct thematic quote from the Ninth Symphony, which even at that time was considered the greatest contribution of man to music. Now, I don't know about you, but when Freude, Schöne, Goethe, Funken happens, I get pretty excited. And still, that hasn't changed in over 150 years. There's a very complicated pedal. Now, this is for the music nerds in the opera. The pedal point fugue is the only authentic fugue in the Requiem. There's a clear subject, a clear counter subject, and it's built on a low D pedal tone that you'll hear in the low strings, the low brass, and the low winds. Brahms was very, very fond of the warmest tones of the orchestra. So the violas have a great deal to do. The contrabassoon has a great deal to do. The low brass has a great... He loved the French horn. People say that John Williams developed his love of the French horn from Brahms. Brahms was one of the first composers that really brought out the French horn as something to be reckoned with. The fourth movement is one that you probably sang in high school chorus. How lovely is thy dwelling place. I sang it in the English. I know I could sing every note from that piece by heart. By far, it's the most excerpted movement of this particular record. Now, here's what you have to hear. Here's the cool inverted melody between the orchestra and the chorus. And you need to listen, make some kind of mark. There's got to be a pencil in there somewhere. Make some mark at the fourth movement, because I think you'll have your afternoon snack time at that point, and you'll be hungry and tired. And I want you to make some kind of mark at the fourth movement to listen for this line. Now, if you look at the notes and then listen to the flute part before it, they are completely inverted. They are reversed and inverted. The same intervals occur between the flute part and the voice part, but they are reversed and flipped. Something that Bach did very often, that Brahms paid homage to in this piece. Again, more music nerd things. More melodic expansion like Lieder rather than regular symphonic exposition and development. And in the fourth movement, you need to listen for the heartbeat, the musical heartbeat. There are moments when the orchestra plays ja, 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 ja. And that is Brahms's heartbeat in the music. He put it in there on purpose so that he could feel that, again, that march to death that he was so fond of talking about. The fifth movement is the first appearance of our soprano, and this is the autograph. The autograph exists in its entirety because, remember, it was written later. If you're looking for beautiful music, you have found it. This movement is sublime in character, sublime in color, a model of lyricism, and expresses his most deep sentiments. It quotes Isaiah 66:13, I will comfort you as a mother comforts his child, her child. Now remember, Brahms' mother would have died right before the writing of this movement. If you're listening for the pain and anguish that he felt, it is poured into every note in this movement. It is stunningly beautiful, stunningly lyrical, and perhaps a complete, perfect piece of music within this record. So when that fifth movement comes, just sit back and be ready to be taken to another place. The end of the movement, the flute carries the soloist's line up to heaven. The soloist stops singing, the winds take it, and there's this beautiful ascendancy of the melody all the way up into the stars. It's absolutely beautiful, and I get teary every time I hear it. So you can check. I'll be sitting somewhere over there with my wife. Look for the glistening. It'll be happening. It's a stunning moment in music. The sixth movement. Denn wir haben keine bleibende Stadt. This is the one, if there was a Dies Irae, this is it. This is the one that gets really intense and really, really exciting. Like Schicksalslied, a new song of fate describes the frailty of man and the immortality of the gods. Man is weak underneath the yoke of the Old Testament God. And this is what Brahms is writing about in this movement. This is the Old Testament God, not our wonderful New Testament God. This is the raining brimstone and fire. It's surprising that he chose not to set the Dies Irae to this particular movement. There are various harmonic vagaries reflecting the restlessness of the text. It's never going to feel like it settles in a key, and that is quite on purpose. The Vivace section most resembles the Dies Irae section of other Requiem Masses, and here's the music dork thing. Look for the strettos, overlapping, angry entrances that increase the musical tension throughout the piece. These strettos will, if you're really, really listening, they'll make your skin crawl, and they're supposed to. It creates dissonance that you otherwise would not expect. Finally, the seventh movement reflects the first, Selig sind die Toten. Instead of Selig sind, blessed are those who are living, now we bless those who are dead. And in this last movement, similar to the opening movement, in that we modulate more than we ever have before. We go from F major now to A major, a highly unrelated key, according to what a romantic or classical composer's rules would dictate. To go from F major to A major, even within one large work, is very, very unusual. Now, if you think about those diatonic relationships, they are very, very far apart between F major and A major. Now, this was a bit of an homage to Haydn. I just got off the podium doing Haydn's Creation last week at Vanderbilt. It was a wonderful performance. As a matter of fact, I saw many of you there, and I thank you for that. One of the things that Creation did in Haydn, he opens the piece in C, the second part is in D, the third part is in E. He is moving away from that initial key because the idea that as man arrived, we created original sin, which brings us so far away from the purity of C major, which God created in the first place. Well, now we're moving away from life and moving to death, from F major to G minor in the middle of the movement, now to A major, far away from where we began. The final word of the movement is the same as the first. There's a beautiful poetry in that. Selig means blessed. And at the end, we're blessing those who have left us. In the beginning, we're blessing those who have remained. Eduard Hanslick is a contemporary of Brahms, and he wrote a lot of music criticism. He didn't like a lot of music. He wrote lots of nasty things about many pieces. However, the German Requiem is a work of unusual significance and great mastery, one of the ripest fruits to have emerged from the style of the late Beethoven in the field of sacred music. Since the Masses for the Dead and mourning cantatas of our classical composers, the shadow of death and the serious of loss the seriousness of loss, have scarcely been presented in music with such power. The harmonic and contrapuntal art, which Brahms learnt in the school of Bach, is inspired by him with the living breath of the present. Now, if I read that in the New York Times today, I would send $20 to that author. Because that is a sentence. That is a mouthful. And that perfectly describes the greatness of what this composer created in a room in Schumann's house. That's the thing that we have to remember. He wasn't at the Esterhazy Palace like Haydn was, and everything that he did was just this lauded, incredible thing. It wasn't like Schumann, who everyone went to his premieres to see what would happen next. And it wasn't like Berlioz, who drew in great crowds simply because the orchestra was 200 players with a choir of 500. Trust me, I could get great houses across the street if I had a choir of 500. No problem. That's what Berlioz did, and that's how he created that kind of motion. Brahms had none of those things. He just had his genius and, of course, reverence for older musical styles. Finally, Brahms might have written the entire Requiem in memory of his mother, anticipating her death. She was, again, quite ill. It's also equally possible that he had in mind his great friend and mentor Robert Schumann, though he left no dedication to the work. This is not like Beethoven's Immortal Beloved. We don't know who he wrote this for. He left us to judge for ourselves, which I think is beautiful. Not surprisingly, the title of Requiem has at times been called into question, but Brahms' stated intention was to write a requiem to comfort the living, not for the souls of the dead. And finally, the seven movements use text from both the Old and New Testament to frame these ageless ideas of salvation. If you're listening today intently, you will hear the greatest of sorrow. You will hear the greatest of redemption. You will hear the absolute depths of what people can go through and the highest heights of how they move past it. This is a pure reflection of the composer in this period of his life, what he was going through, and how he found solace in himself being accountable to his God. I said, one of the first things I said when I said hello to you this afternoon was, this piece is the best we've got. I believe that vehemently. I love Carmina Burana. I love to sit and listen to that piece. It's wonderful. I love that it fills houses and symphony halls. That piece is not even in the same atmosphere as what you're about to hear this afternoon. If you are able to internalize this music, it is one of our great gifts that art can provide humanity, and is my sincerest hope that you will be able to absorb this piece as I do every time I hear it. This is in closing. I just told a student I was speaking to who sings in the choir, I'm not ready to do this piece yet as a conductor. It's not that I couldn't wave my hands in the appropriate spots. It's not as if I couldn't teach it to my students. It's not as if I couldn't give the cue to the harpist. I'm not yet, as a man, emotionally ready to do this piece. But I think I'll know when I am. And I think you'll know when this piece reaches you today. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy Ein Deutsches Requiem by Johannes Brahms. Thank you.